This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
The latest, biggest week of the season is here, and it's begun with two wins from two for Manchester City, and we can't ask for more than that. It was, let's be honest, a comfortable trip to Turf Moor at the weekend, but then any fears that Atletico Madrid's stubbornness would be overly frustrating were buried in the second half by a Kevin De Bruyne effort. Two professional performances from Pep Guardiola's side, maybe for different reasons. But now it's crunch time. Liverpool are up next at the Etihad, and we might know a little more about how the title race will go by the end of Sunday's game. Win and City take a healthy 4-point lead. Lose and they're suddenly having to play catch-up, while a draw probably piles on even more tension for all of us. On today's Blue Moon Podcast, we'll be discussing all of that, plus we'll take a look at some of City's previous nervy games at the Etihad, and we'll hear from a City fan and author whose new book detailing his life growing up supporting the club from afar is out now. I'm David Mooney, and I'm joined by City fan Chris Hickinbottom.
Hello there.
And Goal.com City correspondent Jonathan Smith.
Hello, good to be back.
Welcome back, John. Let's start with you for these two games, because we were talking on last week's show about starting to feel a bit of the nerves. And I said in the intro that it was two professional performances, maybe for different reasons. It's been a good week, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's two victories. It's one game further on in the title race. Safely secured 3 points. A good performance. And an advantage in the Champions League. So yeah, I think it has to be good and as a good week.
Yeah, Chris, when you look at the Burnley game in particular, I thought that when they'd gone two goals up, it was an excellent display in how to conserve energy, keep the opposition at arm's length, but then like not do too much to exert yourself with knowing what's to come.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We were afforded that kind of luxury approach with the early bag, but it was very measured when it was a lot easier than easier is probably the wrong word, it was a lot less fraught than I anticipated, again because of that early goal. But yeah, going into the game I was just like, oh my god, this is going to be horrendous. Like, you know, you're just preparing yourself, steeling yourself against the inevitable horribleness that is playing Burnley. But you know, relatively speaking, it was a walk in the park compared to what I thought it would be.
Yeah, I mean the contrast though, John, is that Atletico really, I mean, they parked a bus. Well, they didn't really park a bus. They parked kind of pretty much every bus they could find in front of that goal at the Etihad. And then as much as we felt like the Burnley game might be fraught, did you feel that fraughtness going into the Atletico game, especially as the minutes ticked by and City hadn't broken them down?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one thing I would say is that I still think, even if it finished 0-0, that City would be, I don't know, if maybe not favourites to go through, but maybe 50-50, even if it had been 0-0, I still would have fancied them to get a result in Madrid. And 1-0 just gives them a slight advantage. I mean, it's going to be interesting how Atletico approach that game, because, I mean, that was the most defensive I've ever seen. And you think about some of the sort of League Two clubs that have come to the Etihad in the FA Cup and the League Cup. Oh, yeah, okay, some of them have had an absolute battering and stuff like that. But there have been teams who have tried to keep it as tight as possible, Championship teams as well, Premier League teams at the bottom, trying desperately. But nothing quite like what Atletico did. And, you know, that's a good side. That's the champions of Spain. They've got talented players. They've got Felix, who's a, you know, brilliant attacker. Obviously, Griezmann, Suarez on the bench. You've got pace all over.
You feel they're better than doing that, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, if you've got great players and you play defensively, I guess in theory you're going to play great defensively. But you know what was? I mean, I was quite kind of surprised after the game how Simeone was almost praised by the Madrid press with some of his questions about how well they'd done, what a great performance it was. You know, that's a €130 million striker playing for you and he didn't have a single shot on or off target. You know, I don't think a Premier League manager would get away with that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, still focusing on the Premier League, Chris, when you think about that Burnley game and how easy City took it in that second half, I did feel like there's extra gear. I mean, maybe even in both performances, there was extra gears needed there if City really needed them, wasn't there?
Yeah, and to an extent, you know, you didn't want them to take the foot off because you're always aware at the back of your mind that goal difference might be a factor. And, you know, when you're in such a, you've got such a grip on a game, in such control, it's like, well, you know, punish them, get the goal tally up. It might be, you know, pivotal at the end of the season. But obviously you've got to have one eye on the next game. It's, as you, as we've said, it's the business end of the season. It's the most important week again of the season. So, yeah, I mean, you, credit where it's due. We did the job that had to be done. If we'd have gone gung-ho and, heaven forfend, got caught on the break by Burnley, then obviously there'd be a massive inquest and people would be absolutely demanding explanations as to why we didn't just
see it out,
you know,
yeah.
Remain satisfied with the 3 points. And to be honest, with the if I may, you know, the Atletico game, I kind of have a respect for the way Simeone did that. I mean, he knows what his priority is there. He wants to come away. It's a complete damage limitation, isn't it? Very negative, but they did set a few traps for us in that setup. And it's credit to us that we didn't allow them, when the few occasions that they did steal the ball off us, we didn't allow them any sniffs in attack. I know they weren't set up for attack, but they were set up to break when they could. But we nullified that as well. It was that tight that the channel to Sterling, it seemed to me about three quarters of the time, was actually blocked by the ref because he just didn't have anywhere else to go. He kept standing in that kind of inside left channel and we were looking for Sterling. And it's like, ref, you're in the way again. I know it's tight, man, but stand somewhere else. Like, you know, the ref couldn't even find space and he was like an extra defender for them. It was ridiculous.
It's a great asset to have sometimes as the away side, isn't it?
Well, yeah, 12 men. Yeah, it is, yeah. They're like, I likened them to Burnley with a tan, Atletico. They were that negative, but yeah, a begrudging respect from me.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to what Guardiola thought of the performance, because he was asked afterwards about the display in basically in the way that they had to break down two banks of Atletico's players.
During 25-30 minutes, play 5-5, so it's so difficult to find spaces, which happened long years ago, will be now, will be in the future. But we were patient enough, except the first 10-15 minutes, the second half. We attack not the right rhythm. We would like to talk more about our rhythm, but the way we play is the way we played. But yeah, good result. We won the game. Yeah, we won in Burnley, won today. Prepare next one.
For a pledge of $2 a month, you can hear our weekly bonus show on a wide range of City topics. There's more details on patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast.
He seems quite chipper, I think, John.
Yeah, he is very relaxed at the moment. And certainly after the Burnley game, when he came into the press conference after the match, he was absolutely sort of buzzing with it because, it was a game that City would expect to win, obviously, but I think it was a reflection of where the team are. You know, they get up for these games, and obviously coming off the back of that Palace game when they were a little bit anxious, they were right on it from the start, got the early goals, killed the game, controlled it. Like Chris was saying, you know, I think City do deserve a lot of credit in terms of the way they played Burnley and Atletico. They just kept them so far away from goal that they haven't created a chance. When you look at the heat map from the game against Atletico Madrid, everything was played in the last 20 yards of the pitch almost. So that, you know, there's always there is a risk with so much wide open space to run into, and it's just, you know, there was maybe a little glimpse of it at the first few minutes when there was a ball over the top where Nathan Ake was sprinting for a long way, but he got there and that was kind of it.
I was worried at that point. It was like, oh my god, he's faster than him. We're in for a torrid time here. His number was up.
It looked like that might be the way that Atletico would try and find a weak spot in. But, you know, Ake has been superb in both games.
I was going to say, Chris, it's been a big week for Ake, hasn't it? His stock must be rising at the minute. I think he's had a really difficult kind of start to his City career because he spent pretty much the whole of the first season injured, and then he's been in and out of the team since, and he's like not been able to put a run of the games together. Suddenly, he's been asked, you know, can you do it on two games this week? And the answer is yes, he can.
Yeah, he kind of cuts the figure of someone who is nervously trying to establish like a proper rhythm, which isn't at all easy or even possible if you're not playing that many games. And we're no strangers to seeing people come in and take up to a year to gel, I believe is the term, into the side.
Technical term, that one.
yeah, absolutely. But like, he's done really well. He's been competent without being, standout amazing, but that's also testament to the way the team's playing because he's not been needed to do anything much other than kind of the bread and butter stuff. But when called upon, what he's needed to do, he's done really well. I think people, there's not that many things to be negative about our team with, and people seem to see him as a bit quick to chide sometimes with Daki, and it's like, well, what do you expect from the man? I mean, he's done pretty well most of the time. He seems to be passing well. He makes sensible decisions. He's very good in the air. I mean, he's just, you know, he's ticking all the boxes for me.
Yeah, likes a goal line clearance as well, John. I mean, he didn't know it was going to be offside, but it was a good clearance.
Yeah. I mean, I watched the highlights on Match Today later, and I thought, God, it looked like a really good game. That looked really close because they showed sort of three chances for Burnley, including that one that was offside. And
I forgot about that.
I mean, it wasn't really the story of the match. City absolutely battered them. But yeah, I'm kind of really happy for Ake because I think this is why he joined the club, and a lot he's coming for a little bit of stick of, you know, why have you joined City? You just sit on the bench and stuff like that. Well, you know, this is it. These are the weeks where he's around to say, when the chance comes, I'm ready to play and I won't let you down. And, you know, I think he's been a little bit unfortunate. When you go back to the summer he was signed, you know, John Stones was nowhere. And he's gone from nowhere to being back to being, well, he is the best England centre-back going. And that's harmed Nathan Ake because, you know, alongside Diaz and Laporte, he's very much kind of the fourth choice. But this is his chance to come in for a run of big matches and to do so well. And it's great for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair meritocracy, isn't it, that Pep runs, and you play well, then you can cement your place. And I think, you know, there's a few examples of that. Another thing as well, sorry to cut in, my sister saw him in a restaurant with Kevin De Bruyne. Aki was with De Bruyne, not my sister. But people were asking to take photos, and Aki, when the people went over, the fans, to interrupt their meal for photos, he actually said, "What, me too?" Oh. So he wasn't even expecting to be asked to be in the photo. So if you want a metaphor for how he feels about being in the picture, then maybe that sums it up, because he's been trying to establish himself. Doesn't maybe quite feel 100% involved, but keeps putting performances in like that, then power to him, he will be.
That makes me feel really sad.
There was one at Barcelona, I think, where I can't remember who the player was, but a fan asked Messi to take the picture of the fan with this player. So, you know, if it happens to Messi.
It happens to the best, yeah. Guardiola was also asked after the game about the relationship between, the impact from Phil Foden from the bench. I want to talk about this because I want to talk about the kind of growing relationship between Foden and De Bruyne. This is what Guardiola said about bringing Foden on.
His reception is always forward. His spaces in the first steps are massive. I have the composer to make an incredible assist to Kevin and do it. And after the two actions, yeah, Phil was brilliant. We knew it in the beginning with Gabriel and him, especially when we need, you know, to change when the game was a little bit flat, what happened could change it when they were a little bit more tired. And Jack for the control of the game, give continuity to the game, and they did it and they were brilliant.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
Yeah, there is a relationship blossoming, certainly between Foden and De Bruyne, isn't there, Chris?
Yeah, you can see it. I mean, I don't know if it was ever kind of not there. They're two very supremely talented footballers. You'd expect them to, you know, be able to work out each other's movement and playing together and stuff. But the way they combined with Phil coming off the bench against Atletico, it was, he had a point to prove, didn't he? You could see the way he was really on it, that he perhaps thought he should have started, but I think perhaps we might not have got that level of intensity from him if it had started the game. But some of the footwork he was showing and like that outside of the left foot pass to De Bruyne, obviously the Megs for the goal, and where
there was one City didn't score from it, but there was one where he did that thing that I can't do, where
little kind of shimmy across.
But he did it like three times in a row and beat defender after defender after defender, got to the byline and cut it back, but it didn't quite find I think it was De Bruyne, and it was just like, oh, please score that.
I loved that. But yeah, he looked absolutely fantastic. And did you see the look on his face after the goal?
I didn't, no.
If you look at the little celebratory huddle, look on Phil's face, he's just sort of dead eye, not laughing, just like the most determined, kind of focused, steely-eyed glare on his face as he pumped the air with his fist and got a nice little cuddle off the lads. It was just, I was like, yes, Phil. Yes, Phil, you are so up for this. That was all about you. Go on.
Yeah. John, there's two De Bruyne goals this week. It kind of feels like, I mean, he's the star player that everybody talks about anyway, but it kind of feels like he's quietly kind of flicked the switch for the end of the season, hasn't he? So it's almost like he's put himself in gear to go.
Yeah. I think Pep mentioned it after the match. He said he's coming into a good moment, and I think that's five goals in five games now, is it, for De Bruyne? So, yeah, and also, obviously, didn't join up with Belgium in the international break, so maybe had a little bit of a rest. You know, he's very relaxed anyway. You know, once the game's over, he kind of takes himself out of it with his family and what have you. But, yeah.
His family and Nathan Ake.
Yeah.
And
his little brother. I mean, we all know how good De Bruyne is, but when he's in this mood, you know, I think obviously with no striker this season, his stats are a little bit different to what we normally associate with him. Obviously, the assists are down. That's because he hasn't got that natural movement of a striker where he knows exactly what's going on. It's a little bit, you know, the false number nines are not always playing on the shoulder of the last defender, so that perhaps doesn't work to De Bruyne's skills so much. But he's making up for it with goals. You know, it was a great strike against Burnley. I don't want to get into a debate about XG, but I looked at it off that goal and it was 0.07, which I thought, I don't know, was it maybe the angle I was at? I thought it was a better chance than that. Maybe it was just a great finish. And then obviously against Atletico, there were so few chances. And when it came, he made no mistake. So that was brilliant.
I just want to finish with a quick chat about Jack Grealish, John, because he only came on for 20 minutes and then he seemed to just get kicked up and down the pitch since he got on against Atletico. What have you got any idea what he did to upset them?
I don't think he did anything to upset them. I would guess, I don't know this, but I think that maybe Atletico have looked at Grealish and thought he's someone that can be wound up. We saw it earlier in the season at Southampton, that draw against Southampton when Romeo was pinching him throughout the game and just sort of irritating him, and it worked. He got a rise out of Grealish. He lost a little bit of his composure. I think we've seen it a couple of times for England as well. So I think they were just trying to wind him up. And yeah, I think Pep's message was, you know, you got to deal with this stuff and get on with it. And
fouled man, isn't he?
I think he's one of those players who makes the most of his fouls. You know, he always looks like it's far nastier than it actually is. I mean, the one where he got the ball booted at him, I initially thought he'd gone straight into his face.
Could have killed him.
Yeah, exactly. Famously could have killed him. But, you know, he's just got to deal with it, hasn't he? This is Atletico. This is what they're going to do. They're going to try everything they can to upset you and put you off your game. And he's just got to get on with it.
Yeah, Chris, what would you make of him this week? Because obviously he was in the thick of it with Atletico, but also I thought he had quite a good game against Burnley as well, and it's kind of gone like untalked about.
Yeah, it's been untalked about, but when he's not doing enough in people's eyes, that's very much talked about. Again, it's like we have this complaints void, don't we, as City fans now, that we're seeking to fill because we're so used to historically having so much to moan about. But he's doing really well. People wanted him to be more positive and influence games more. I think he's doing that gradually. Again, it comes down to players coming in and taking time to get into the stride. I think Pep is instrumental in kind of curbing some of the wilder instincts of players when they settle into the system and saying, concentrate on doing this and this and see how you go. And then we'll, you know, I think that he's not receiving the ball, turning and trying to take people on time because he's been specifically told not to do that and just to keep the ball. It's a completely different scenario to Villa. But he's doing really well. I can't really fault him. I can't really fault him for getting annoyed that someone's kicked a ball in his face, because if you're in that situation, it happens. It's impossible not to react. But I do concede that, you know, you must be kind of expecting them to try and wind you up. They were flicking him in the hair, weren't they? And like, you know, coming behind him, flicking his head and stuff. I don't know. Maybe it's the Gucci
the deal.
Contract. Maybe they're all Dolce & Gabbana guys. Maybe there's just a rivalry there.
Yeah, I'm certainly not going to lay into anyone for getting wound up like that, because anyone who's ever played with me on a football pitch knows it takes nothing to wind me up. So yeah, I'm not one to start preaching. I definitely don't practice what I preach in that situation. Now, to finish the first part of the show, this is a topic that we've had to come back to all too many times on the podcast, but you might have seen the video on social media of Atletico Madrid fans doing Nazi salutes during Tuesday's game. Now, we've asked UEFA for a comment on the video and whether they'll be investigating the incident. We haven't heard anything yet, but we will keep you updated on the situation. I've seen a report in the Manchester Evening News as well that reports of racism were made to Greater Manchester Police at the game and that arrests have been made. They also say that they think that City are looking into the incidents from the game and will be reporting anything they find to UEFA. But whether there's going to be a formal investigation into the allegations, we don't know. But we will keep you updated on anything that UEFA says. Now, we've all got our own individual stories of growing up as a City fan. For one supporter, though, City's fortunes on and off the pitch always seem to mirror his experiences growing up, even as soon as picking City as his club, he ended up moving away. I've been speaking to Dickie Denton, the author of the new book Feeling Blue, about his memories of crossing the Pennines to get to Main Road, being the only City fan in a school of Leeds supporters and ending up amongst United fans when Sergio Aguero scored in May 2012.
I moved to Leeds when I was about 1975, just before City won the League Cup actually. And yeah, I was a new kid at a school in Leeds, and the only thing I knew about Leeds fans was when they'd wrecked the Parc des Princes Stadium after the European Cup final in 75. So I had this view in my hand of Leeds fans, and Leeds kids, actually, they just seemed a lot harder than Manchester kids at school. So, yeah, I don't think I ever said I supported Leeds, but I kept it quiet that I supported City. And that was until the League Cup final, because my teacher class was a Geordie. A guy called Mr. Foster, who was actually the brother of Brendan Foster, the Olympic athlete. And so he went to the 76 League Cup final, came in the next Monday at school, held up the programme and said whoever could tell him anything about the game could get to read the programme at lunchtime. And I thought, well, my hand just went straight up then, and, you know, I named the whole team, the referee, the scorers, everything, and it all came out, and yeah, felt really good. Felt really good, actually, getting it all out there. And yeah, and after that, it was City. Everybody knew about it, and yeah.
Was that easy or difficult growing up away from City and not really being in contact with them?
Yeah, it was. You know, Leeds at the time as well were just coming out of the great Revy years. So Leeds were a massive footballing city, and you know, And football was becoming very tribal in those days as well. It was when sort of football hooliganism started as well. And, you know, you want to be fit in with those around you. So, yeah, it was a struggle. But it also gave me a point of difference and something that made me stand out a little bit and a real sense of pride. And once it was out there, I wasn't going to shy away from it. So every Man City Leeds game would you know, inevitable sort of, you know, piss-taking and beforehand and afterwards. And as I got a bit older, you know, the piss-taking became a little bit more physical at times, if I'm perfectly honest, in the playground. But, you know, that was it. And very famous cup tie in 78 when Man City Leeds when City won at Elland Road, went 2-0 up, and the whole of the cop at Elland Road attacked Joe Corrigan, it seemed, and the police came on and all that, and that was interesting at school the next day.
Well, you were in the Leeds end.
Not for that game, no. I was for a game previously when my dad took me to my first ever game at Elland Road. My mum had just knitted me my first City scarf. My dad took me and my sister and my brother David, who is of Asian heritage as well, so it was quite a strange family dynamic. My dad was a university lecturer. He hadn't got a clue about football. He was from Northampton, a university lecturer. Didn't understand football. Didn't know where to go at Elland Road. Paid £3 or whatever, and we ended up in the Gelded Road end, which was a cop at Leeds, which was there. And me with my city scarf on, we lost 2-1, and we got away with it that day. But that cup tie with the year after that, or a couple of years after that, actually.
You admit in the book your first game was a United game.
Yes,
you wanted to be a ball boy at United, but it was City that gave you the opportunity in the end.
It was, yeah. So I went to this first game. It was United Sunderland 74 when they were in the second division, and I saw these ball boys at the side, red tracksuits, and I thought, I could do that. And so I wrote them a letter to Old Trafford. My dad got the Woolworths pad out and wrote the letter. Never got a reply. And then, just as coincidence would have it, what, 5-6 years later, in the City programme, I've got a season ticket at City by then, I'm 13. I read in there, do you want to be a ball boy at Manchester City? And so, you know, wrote another letter. And, yeah, they invited me down and... for an interview, and, you know, inverted commas, a very loose interview, told me what we had to do, and so I became a point to be a ball boy, and so that was 79-80 season, and then the 80-81 season, the following season, when John Bond came along, and we got to the cup final, and that, so I did it for about a year, and it was a fantastic experience to be in that inner sanctum of Main Road, which is, you know, nothing compared with what the Etihad looked like now. It was all wood panels and Eddie Large the comedian used to come into the ball boys' dressing room and entertain us beforehand. And I say ball boys' dressing room, it was a storeroom for corner flags and all the other crap that they use on match day. But yeah, we loved it. Yeah.
What, I mean, you mentioned a few times as well that kind of City's fortunes mirrored your academic fortunes,
yes.
and so on. Mm. How did that carry on through the rest of kind of growing up?
I mean, City's fortune up and down. My academic fortunes up and down. And I suppose every sort of career decision I took after that was sort of was guided by City. It was front of mind all always. You know, I moved out. You know, I haven't lived in Manchester since I was 8. Yeah, so every game's been almost like an away game to me. But I'd always choose the city that went to based on the football teams and where I could get to and the jobs. You know, I could do the other company car and can I get up to City? And too far, an opportunity came up to go to the States as well, which made it a little bit different.
I was going to say, you wouldn't have been commuting that one, would you?
I wouldn't have been commuting that one. I remember, you know, and I put it in the book, I remember them asking me about, you know, would you be willing to go to the States? And the first thing I was thinking, because it was just after the Gillingham game, it was after the playoff final, City were on the up, and we were getting the sense, actually, under Royal, we could be doing something here. You know, so before I started thinking about salary or security or healthcare or accommodation, I was going, what time's the kickoff in America? And will I be able to get back? And actually, it did a deal where the company flew me back for a couple of games.
There's one big question here now, because where were you on the 13th of May 2012?
Well, fast forward and 3 years in the States, back to the UK. then 2008 to... The crazy thing was, Diageo, who I worked for, offered me a job in Hong Kong on the 31st of August 2008, the day of the takeover. Yeah, and it's another one where I'm going, should I be going or should I not? But I went. So I went to Asia, Hong Kong for a year, then in Singapore. So I was in Singapore to cut to the end. A place called Robertson Quay, which is mainly inhabited by sort of expats and Korean, which is a lot of open space and lots of bars, big screens, Tiger Towers, which were 2.5 litre jugs of Tiger beer, watching the football. And me and a mate, who as far as I knew at the time was Singapore's only other City fan, would meet there late at night, of course, because of time difference, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock normally at night, sit there and watch City games. So yeah,
but I mean, of course, there's a reputation for there being a lot of United fans in Asia. So if you're a City fan there with, you know, late at night, a couple of minutes to go, United are winning the title.
Yeah, it was. It was United fans, Arsenal fans, Liverpool fans. You know, a lot of people look at that day with great memories. I look at it with great memories, but I also look at it as, for most of that night, I was in a dark place. A real, just thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing to myself? Surrounded by United fans, been following this team for so long. Tonight was supposed to be payback night. It was supposed to be payback night. And there I'm going, this is just the worst ever. And as Zabaleta goes down, wins that last corner, I pull out a handful of Singapore dollar notes, give them to my mate next to me who's watching it with me, and say, "I'm my phone, mate." Yeah, yeah. He says, "No, stay." Yeah.
And then Dzeko scored.
Yeah, and then Dzeko scored. And I thought, I just thought, we're going to get one more chance. We're going to get one more chance. And yeah.
So what was that moment like then? Because I mean, for a lot of your all your life, you've been quite disconnected from City in that sense. Yeah. You've been a long way away from the club.
Yeah.
So Aguero scores, and there's you and your mate, and nobody else. What was that like?
Well, funny enough, my mate Chris, who's next to me, isn't the City fan. My mate Ryan is actually. There was a problem on the feed of the TV in Singapore, and it kept buffering. And it kept buffering all through the second half. A bit like City's performance. In the book, I compare it to City's performance. It just kept stopping and starting. Oh, and my mate Ryan had gone to find another bar with a better feed. So he's gone and go, "Where's my mate Ryan? Where's my mate Ryan?" And I'm just watching this, thinking, "One more chance, one more chance." And then, funnily enough, as we scored, I get up and my friends are congratulating me as if I scored the winning goal, having not spoken to me for 20 minutes because they're not scared of how I'm going to react. It's like I've got a terminal illness. They didn't know what to say. And then other pockets of people come out there, and all the just those Liverpool fans and Arsenal fans suddenly start cheering. People just coming in and congratulating me. And eventually my mate Ryan comes back, and he has found a bar. He's gone running down to Singapore River, taken a duck, come back. We hug each other like survivors of a shipwreck, reunited on a safe shore. We just hug each other and, what a night. Yeah.
The book's called Feeling Blue.
It's by Pitch Publishing. It's just Google Feeling Blue and Dickie Denton, and I won't favour any one particular retailer on it because of the it's listed with most retailers, online retailers on it.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast.
That was author Dickie Denton speaking to me about his new book. It's now time to introduce Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap. Hi, Neil.
Hello there.
Obviously, we are previewing the game with Liverpool this weekend and the second leg with Atletico Madrid next Wednesday. Neil, from a Liverpool point of view, from a City point of view about Liverpool, your form looks worryingly good at the moment. How are you playing?
We're playing well. We're doing what needs to be done in games. I don't think, you know, Liverpool aren't putting in some sort of 90-minute performances where they're taking sides to the absolute cleaners. They're managing themselves through games. They're looking after the ball when they need to. They're looking after their opponent when they need to. They're a different proposition to the side that City faced last October. I think that is fair to say. I think that there's a number of things different from then to now. I don't think it's as straightforward as one or two factors. I think that they're defending a little bit differently. I think it's worth sort of remembering in that game, you know, Van Dijk had only been back 2 months. Now he's from a long, long, long-term injury. Now he's very much, you know, a corner has been turned with him in general, I think, a little bit in there. And I think that Liverpool, they are a different proposition, a better all-round proposition than the side back in last October. But I don't think that necessarily counts for a great deal in this game from the point of view of the fact that, listen, these, I think, are the two best teams in the world facing one another. And it's going to be a really, really sort of tight affair that'll be settled by one, maybe two goals if one side's on top and the other one manages to break away towards the end of the game. I'm going into this one like it's a genuine clash of the Titans.
Yeah, John, from a City point of view, how much of a balancing act is this game with the Atletico second leg after the games that they've just had this week?
Yeah, obviously Pep rested a couple of players away at Burnley. Bernardo wasn't involved. John Stones coming back from international break with a slight niggle was rested for that one. So, and Kyle Walker missed the game against Atletico through suspension. So you think, okay, those two haven't played in both those two big games. I would see it that Pep will go into these two as the biggest matches of the season so far, and I think we've seen in the past that if it's the FA Cup that has to take a bit of a second team, or well, more of a rotation, that's the way it will go. So
the way it was last season, wasn't it?
Certainly, yeah. So I think he will go as strong as possible, because, you know, it's been interesting throughout the Champions League stages where you thought perhaps it was a little bit a game that it could go a bit easier on in terms of his going full strength. He's always picked big players and maybe rested them for the Premier League. So there's no doubt the Champions League is a big one. But you know, in a week of a FA Cup, Premier League and Champions League match, it's the FA Cup, which comes very much third.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Neil, does the FA Cup change Klopp's thinking for this game any, do you think?
No, not at all. I think that from Liverpool's point of view, it's much the same as has just been described there, to be quite honest with you. I think the one thing that we have is we've got a 3-1 lead against Benfica. We've got the second leg at home, and we've got the ability within that to feel as though I think Benfica gave us their best shot the other night. I really do. And I think that they took a number of gambles, but ultimately they rocked up to that game with a centre-half partnership of Nicolas Otamendi and Jan Vertonghen.
You don't need to speak to us about Nicolas Otamendi. We've got long experience of Nicolas Otamendi, yeah.
And you've got experience of Nicolas Otamendi in what we can describe as his pomp. this is a Nicolas Otamendi whose career is only moving one way at this point, and that is with the greatest of respect and the greatest respect to Benfica. They gave us the best shot, and ultimately we're 3-1 up now. Listen, Liverpool will not take Wednesday night for granted in any way, shape, or form. There'll be tons of professionalism. But, you know, we've got a 2-goal lead going into that game. We're now at home and we can go from there. The Cup, I think it'll almost be, he'll have a look at who's in what nick come Friday and work that one out. And I think that Guardiola will do exactly the same thing. It's, from a City point of view, it's all about Sunday and Wednesday. I think from a Liverpool point of view, it's more able to be all about Sunday just simply because of where the ties are at and the relative quality of the opposition. But for me, the Cup is a very, very, very distant third, to the point that if you offered me a horrible, undeserved 1-0 win at the Etihad on Sunday, and then next week in the Cup, you embarrass us 7-0 at Wembley with the world watching, I would take that right now rather than anything else. So I think that it'll be the same for all parties. The idea is, it's all about the league game. And then from a Manchester City point of view, obviously Wednesday does at least have something on the horizon for City.
Yeah, Chris, it feels like, when you take all the factors into account for this week, it feels like this is the most knife edge it's been for a long time. And what I mean by that is, City's lead in the table is 1 point. Liverpool have a slightly better goal difference. That doesn't really matter for much off this game because, you know, whatever the result
you know, goal difference isn't going to matter this week. But then Liverpool have, City have got the game at home, which is a slight advantage there. But Liverpool have the slight advantage in the Champions League, as Neil was saying there, because their tie is slightly more advantageous in their favour. It feels like it's a real kind of, like, it could go one way or the other, this, couldn't it?
It's precarious, isn't it? Just listening to the lads describe it there, and I'm getting these like vertiginous flutters of panic in my chest, just trying to weigh it up. And yeah, it really could be a massive swing towards either a really positive end or a doomsday scenario kind of end to the season. I mean, I can't really add. I can't like give you a fresh hot take compared to how the lads have described the upcoming fixtures, because I can't really disagree with anything that they've said.
Well, let me play you this. This is Guardiola speaking after the game against Atletico about how he thinks the second leg is going to go. This is what he said.
I don't judge what they do or when they are going to do, because I don't know. So I don't. It's not I don't care. Of course I care, but it's more the fact that okay, we've for the game, it was one game with 1-0, and after 1-0 was a little bit different. Okay, Lemar started to jump. All the players start to press a little bit higher, and they make a little bit more combination. And I guess high part of the game in Madrid will be more what happened in the last maybe 50-20 minutes after the goal than what happened before.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast, facebook.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
So, Chris, would you be happier with Atletico setting up a little bit more open than they did in the at the start of the game with City's 1-0 lead? Is that like has that goal actually made this week slightly easier for City in knowing that Atletico can't sit back at their own place for 90 minutes and, you know, try and bore the game out?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just watching the home leg though, the way we set up against their kind of back 10. You know, we kind of matched them. We had five across the front a lot of the time. Maybe it would have been, you know, you at the time you're thinking, well, maybe we should just let them come out a little bit and then we can get in behind a bit more. But the goal does change it. They're going to have to come out. The only worry is the sort of wind-up factor that they've got. If we can keep our heads and be ultra professional about it, then we really should be winning that game. And if we're going in there 0-0, then yeah, I would feel a little bit more horrible about it.
Yeah, Neil. The obviously for this game, this weekend game is the one where either side can really take an advantage in the title race. Who's available for you? Who's not available? Who do you want to see in the team?
I think ultimately Liverpool are picking from certain options and certain positions for this one. So just be really clear, it'll be up front. It could be three from any of the five. So Firmino, Jota, Mane, Salah and Diaz, I think, are all going to be in the shake-up. It'll be three from any of those five to start.
Is Jota the one at the moment? Because he seems the one in form.
He's the one who's... So the Jota question and the Jota thing is Liverpool, in sort of a holistic way, I think, play football slightly less well when Jota is on the pitch, but he is the one who's most likely to score. So scoring is the aim of the whole thing. Your goals help. But Liverpool, I think Jota's funny. Since he's come in first season was under pandemic and second season's now. And first season under pandemic, he had a bad injury, as a lot of Liverpool players did. And we weren't playing all that well. And now second season's now. And he's never really in the same way that other players have had the opportunity to do so. He's never really got to build up proper relationships within the team. So Mane interacts really, really well with Robertson and a couple of other players in there. The right-hand side with Salah, Henderson and Arnold all works really well. Jota's move between left and central predominantly whilst he's played for us, so he's not really got, like, it's not clear who his mate is, if you sort of know what I mean, whereas other players have got more relationships, they've been here longer, but also they've played in a more fluent Liverpool team for longer as well. So Jota's a bit of a funny one. So he is the one who, you know, ultimately if one of our players is clean through with five to go and it's a tied game at that point, I would most like it to be Diogo Jota. But the flip side is whether or not the quality of football is whilst he plays. His pressing's really good, don't get me wrong. He's great out of possession. It's just little bits when he's in possession. So it'll be three from those five, and then it'll be three from four in the middle of the park. Fabinho, Thiago, Henderson and Keita. I suspect Fabinho will definitely start. I'd be 90% on Thiago, and then it's a split between Henderson and Keita for the other position. Whichever one doesn't start will definitely come off the bench. And then at the back, it'll be Arnold right back, it'll be Robertson left back, it'll be Van Dijk, and I'd be... Konate plays well midweek, but I suspect Konate plays midweek to ensure that Matip starts this one. So there's question marks in attack. There's one question mark, I think, in midfield. Back four and goalkeeper to be, as you'd expect. And everyone is sort of broadly available. Keita has had a bit of an injury thing, but he plays 90 minutes against Benfica, which would suggest he won't start this. But it wouldn't surprise me if the manager in the end decides to go with Keita for an hour and then have the option of Henderson to do 90 minutes running in 30 to help see the game home, whatever condition it's in.
Yeah. John, from a City side, how different do you think the teams will be for Liverpool on Sunday than Atletico on Wednesday?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, the game against Atletico, that Foden didn't start. It felt like he was actually... saw the way the game was going to go, saw that they're going to have to tie them out, and then had these options of fresh legs in Foden and Grealish. You know, I'd expect Phil to start against Liverpool. It's going to be interesting how the second leg goes. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a similar sort of scenario where Atletico just defend and trying to keep it 0-0 for an hour. So I don't see... I think a bit like Neil was saying about Liverpool, I think he's going to look at who's in form and who's playing well and who's fit and who's 100% ready and pick the best out of them.
Yeah. Chris, for Wednesday's Atletico game, how much of it do you think will be about who's still got energy in the legs? Because we've seen Liverpool games at the Etihad for a long time now be really, really high-paced, you know, real energy-sapping performances from both teams. If Atletico are going to sit deep and kind of try and kill the game again, does it really matter if City go kind of like 110% for 90 minutes on Sunday?
Well, it remains to be seen, really. I mean, you want form players, you want rhythm, don't you? You want people who are playing well to continue in that vein. I mean, by the same token, though, it was a masterstroke to take Foden out of the reckoning against Atletico in the first game, because when he came on, he was just absolutely bang up for it. And like I was saying earlier, the look in his eye, just a sense of determination in him was a step up from what is normally a very determined professional anyway. But the game against Liverpool, there's so many variables in that. You don't know how it's going to go. He's probably got a number of plans outlined for how he's going to proceed after the Liverpool game, because, you know, it's been so billed, isn't it? It might just be a really drab 0-0. And he's like, well, that's that one out of the way.
As it happens, I don't see that happening, really.
Well, you know, this is the thing, though. Everybody doesn't see it happening, so it might well do. I hope it isn't. But I think he's going to be... It's going to be fairly reactive from the Liverpool game rather than being sort of proactive looking forward to the Madrid game now. A lot will depend on what happens in that Liverpool game, I feel.
Yeah.
In terms of energy expended, how people play, and, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a couple of injuries, because there's a lot on the line, isn't there?
Yeah. Neil, in terms of this game, obviously after this game, both teams will have seven games left. Do either of them need to win it?
I don't think so, no, to be honest. If we win it, we're too clear, and there's still everything to play for from a Manchester City perspective. I think it's important Liverpool don't lose it, because I think four clear does shift mentalities. It shifts mentalities both from a City point of view, but also I think from a Liverpool point of view. Like, suddenly, you know, if we get through to the next round, I still think it's likely we play Bayern Munich, even though they have a negative result against Villarreal. But in the middle of that, we've got Newcastle at 12:30, on a Saturday away. And if we're 4 points behind City come that game, the manager will be well within his rights to focus on Europe, I would argue. So I think it's important Liverpool don't lose it, and I don't think we need to win it. I think there's a lot of chat about who's got, in inverted commas, the easier running. I think for these two sides, they are so vastly superior to every other team in the division. The only side that I think can hold a candle to them on their day is Chelsea, and we've both played them twice. So I'm not, you know, we've got to play Manchester United, but as we all know, Manchester United are rubbish. So there'll be a thing where everyone will act like that's
a massive
game. You've
got Everton yet, mate.
Yeah, we've got Everton and my word, you know, there'll be a lot of chat as though Liverpool's running is tougher than City's. I sort of just don't think it is. I'm more worried. I've got mild concerns about Tottenham at home because they're more than capable of upsetting any apple cart, as City have discovered this season, and we discovered when we went to their place. But ultimately, I'm more worried about Villa away. And if I was a City supporter, I'd be more worried about Wolves away potentially than hypothetically if you'd had to play Man United again away. And this is the truth of where these two sides are. For me, it's not... Listen, if I was looking at City's running and they managed to somehow have Norwich six times, then I'd be saying, absolutely, you know, theirs is far, far, far more straightforward. But, you know, City have still got to go to West Ham. That won't be easy. City themselves, when they seem to drop points, it seems to a little bit come out of nowhere. There's some teams that sit between sort of 7th and 15th that just have a good sense of how to play against City.
Yeah.
That side that sit 4th, 5th and 6th just sort of don't. Like, you know, honestly, if City had Arsenal away between now and the end of the season, I would not have a red circle around that as a potential drop points game. But I potentially would, as I said before, about Wolves or Villa.
West Ham, yeah.
West Ham. So I think that there'll be a lot of chat about that. But ultimately, both of these sides are capable of drawing on Sunday and then both winning every game from then until the end of the season. They are both capable of that. And if that happens, you know, maybe I'm more philosophical, but we can shake hands and go home and we can start again in August because that's what's going to happen. And City can lift the league and that's great. And I hope we go and win the Champions League or the FA Cup or both. There's like, this is sort of the business end, but the flip side of it being the business end for me is you have to be attuned to the idea that if we are dealing with the two best teams in the world, and I genuinely think we are, then one will win or one will lose come the end of May. But that won't mean the end of anything for either of them. It means that some seasons you just come off second best and you shake hands. And maybe that's a bit easier for us because at the start of the season, there was the ridiculous thing with the BBC, and it was ridiculous at the time, where there was, you know, the vast majority of BBC pundits, and by vast majority, I think I mean all but one, didn't put Liverpool to finish top three. As though Chelsea and Manchester United have ever won in the last 5 years, 8, 9, 10 consecutive Premier League games. Whereas
wasn't
Liverpool
aware of that. That's pretty amazing to me.
Yeah, all but one did not have Liverpool in the top three. All but one. And it's ridiculous. It was ridiculous then. It was ridiculous at the time. Because my position all the way through was Liverpool and Manchester City, the current iterations, know how to win. Go on long winning and unbeaten runs in this league, and United and Chelsea just don't. And guess what? Chelsea go and get whacked 4-1 by Brentford at the weekend, and then drop point. Sorry, get embarrassed by Real Madrid because they're just not as good, and they won't be as good in August either, probably. And you know, for me, whatever happens this weekend, I'm really looking forward to it because, firstly, one of the best games I've ever seen was the January 2019 game. It was literally one of the best games of football you've ever seen. Secondly, as I said to David on the show the other week, we've really quickly forgotten as humans that 12 months ago we would not have been able to attend this match. We've all forgotten that. We've all took that for granted. Now we can, so let's absolutely look forward to it and relish every minute of it. But the other thing is, we're going to be doing it again. We're doing it again in the semi-final. We might end up doing it again in the Champions League final. We're doing it again for certain next season because, thankfully, unlike Everton, neither of us are going down. and then next season, it could come in another massive game. You know, in people's minds, I think when there's a massive game like this, it feels like it's the end of everything, no matter what the result is one way or the other. Nothing's finished on Sunday. The final whistle goes and there's still however many more league games to play, however many more games all comps to play. You've got to go off to Madrid and see if you can get through there, you know.
That's why I think it's going to be a damp squib and like a nil, and then everyone goes,
I think there's a chance that I think if it was, I'd love to know what both managers do if it's 0-0 on 70, because it genuinely wouldn't surprise me if in the subtle way that sometimes happens in football matches, both managers sort of go, let's just get out of this now. Yeah. But I think there's a chance it becomes a bit of a runaway game one way or another. And I think if that happens, I think that would just suit Liverpool a little bit more. But then I think it would suit the Etihad. You know, the Etihad factor then comes into it as well if it does become a bit of a runaway game. I'm just really looking forward to it. I genuinely am. I'm really, really looking forward to it. I'm made up. I'm going. I'm not going to the semi-final. I'm going to this. And I'm glad I'm that way around.
Yeah. John, I want to ask you the same question. Does either side need to win this?
I think Neil's pretty much covered it there. I mean, you have to say that whoever comes out of this in front, you can see them winning every game between now and the end of the season. You know, Liverpool can do it, City can do it. you know, when you talk to Pep about approaching, you know, these winning streaks, he just says it's game by game. And when you do that and you go, yeah, you can pick out games that you think are tough, like Wolves away and West Ham away. But when they come round, suddenly everyone can see a victory. And if you do it one by one, it's more than conceivable that after this game, City and Liverpool both win every single match, and that whoever wins on Sunday wins the league.
At this point, Chris, would you be happy with a point? Or would you gamble it to try and get that points advantage?
As much as I want to win it, I would probably, just by virtue of the fact that we're currently ahead, I would take a point, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Pep probably would as well.
Neil, same question. Would you take a point right now?
Just about yes. There's a lot of Liverpool supporters who wouldn't, and I completely understand why. But I think ultimately, I think that a good almost KPI for Liverpool for this season would be to be in everything until the last game. Each of the three remaining competitions, to be in everything until the last game would be great, i.e. the two finals and take this to the last weekend of the season, no matter which way it moves.
Not a bad position to be in, that, is it?
No, it's a and with one trophy already in, you know, it's a fantastic position to be in. It really is. And I wouldn't take that for granted. That said, I might feel differently as the game sort of unfolds, because I think if Liverpool can sense some vulnerability in City, then I think it's important they go for it. I think it's important in every way they go for it and they find a way through. If we get to 45 and City look imperious and Liverpool look immovable, then I'd probably be back to where I am now, which is that, you know, 0-0 is, or 1-1 or whatever's absolutely fine. So I probably would just err on the side of taking a point. Not least because I think there's something else, which is I ultimately think whatever the Manchester City supporters think or feel, I ultimately think that somewhere for the Manchester City players and the Manchester City coach, if at some point a big decision's got to be made in terms of focus and legs between the two tournaments that they remain in, that they really want to win, they'll pick the European one because they've not won it. And that could just come into our favour in the context of City maybe dropping points in one game between now and the end of the season, whereas I don't think that's quite the same for Liverpool. I think we're just happy for either of the big two, and we'll play the hands that were dealt as we go. So there's a little bit of the psychology of that where, let's be clear about this, the Manchester City manager, who, you know, I won't have a word said against, I think he's great, I think he's funny, and I think that people outside of the Manchester City bubble often don't get his jokes. Even the stuff like at Anfield where there's the thing of him, you know, claiming the second-hand ball and ends up sort of putting two fingers to God as he does it, which people laugh at. I think he knows the ridiculousness of that. I really do. I don't think he's that precious. I like him an awful lot. I think, though, he, on a personal level, will be absolutely desperate to win a Champions League with this group. And he'll know that this season's as good a chance as any. So I feel if we got out with a draw, I'd still be pretty confident that if we won every game, we would win the title. I think we wouldn't be able to. We'd have to win every game. Don't get me wrong. I think we'd have to win every game. But if we got out with a draw, I'd have confidence that if we won every game, we would lift the title at the end. And so that's as much of a reason why I'd be happy with a draw as anything else.
Yeah, John, I'll complete the set because I would bite your hand off for a draw right now. What would you do?
I'm not sure. Biting hand off, settle for it. I think if City can win at the weekend, it really is a big advantage, 4 points. I think that changes a lot. But equally, yeah, like I said before, I think Liverpool win, and yeah, you can just see them grinding, getting through those games and winning every single one of them. So a draw keeps everyone happy, keeps it alive, and keeps City slightly ahead.
Keeps me nervous as fuck as well. So yeah, let's get some predictions on the board. We had two wins on last week's show for the charity bet. That takes us to £1,340 for the season so far. We got a bit excited on Twitter and called it our best ever season on the charity bet. Sadly, it's not quite that yet. We need one more win. We actually need about £10. So hopefully we can get there this week. William Hill is giving each of us a £10 correct score single. The winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support, which is helping the Trussell Trust tackle food poverty in Manchester. They collect outside weekend home home games at the Etihad, so they'll be there ahead of the Liverpool game. Go and see them between 2 and 4 o'clock on Sunday. They'll be under the bridge near Asda, so please drop in with a donation if you can. Normally I start with the guests, but there's a reason I'm going to start with the City fans this time. John, what are you going for both Liverpool and the Atletico game?
I've gone 1-1.
1-1 for Liverpool and Atletico?
1-1.
Ah, there we go. Pair of 1-1s is 6-1. And it's a pair of 6-1s as well, so it's 60 quid in both games if you're right. Chris, what are your two scores?
2-1. 2-1.
Yeah, 2-2-1s. 2-1s. A brace of 2-1s. They're both 8-1, so both 80 quid if you're right in either of them. I've gone 1-0 for the Atletico tie, which is 13-2 and £65 if I'm right. Neil, your time to shine. What are you going for this one?
I mean, I want to be quite clear here. David has ever so slightly set me up. He's encouraging us to back a Liverpool win. And then I thought, if Liverpool win, how do I imagine the game going? And I thought, all right, there's a universe where the following happens, which is that it's nip and tuck between the two sides. Liverpool end up getting their noses in front. City begin to claw it back. Liverpool end up 3-1 ahead. City get one back and it goes 3-2. And then Liverpool get a breakaway. And so because it's a charity bet, please do not stake your own money on what I'm about to say is the important part here. But because it's a charity bet, and I presume it'll be pretty big odds if it comes in, and the charity is obviously a fantastic and much needed one at the minute, I have gone for Manchester City 2, Liverpool 4.
Well, you know what?
Just the four.
If we are going to lose the league, and this is the game that happens to it, I hope it happens this way, because it would be the biggest ever win we've had at 90-1 and £900 if you're right.
There we are. That's the spirit. That is the spirit I'm going for in this. For your listeners, if it's three, what I would say to your listeners, if it's 3-2 on 92 minutes and you feel as though it's not happening from a City point of view, maybe will Liverpool to go and get the fourth then. And we can put 900 quid for the food banks.
Yeah, who knows? Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more on gambling responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. Neil, as ever, thank you very much. It's been good fun.
It's always a pleasure.
I'm not going to enjoy Sunday, so I'm not even going to bother with the pleasantries of pretending to say, yeah, oh, enjoy it. Because
all of your
listeners
ignore David and enjoy Sunday. Enjoy Sunday, because 12 months ago you wouldn't have been allowed to go.
Now, this run of games is getting pretty tense. This week we've asked some of our regular guests on the podcast to remember games at the Etihad where they could feel the pressure inside the stands. And it's fallen to me to get biting my nails. After the win over Burnley, Pep Guardiola was pretty relaxed in his press conference. He was asked about the pressure of the end of the season and how his players were reacting.
They know how hard they fought and how tough is the opening, how difficult is the Champions League, how difficult is the FA Cup. And they feel it. Yeah, of course they feel it. But Liverpool feel it too. So they know it.
City fans are no stranger to nerves in big games at this point in the season, especially at the Etihad. Richard Burns picks out the two that he considers the most memorable.
United 2012 and Liverpool 2019 are certainly up there with the tensest I've ever been at the Etihad. I could probably think of games that come close, but I'd be racking my brain somewhat because the rivalry made those ones so tense.
He says the first of those games was a difficult watch.
The United game, City, I think was fraught because City really had things in their hands. But they were heading for that first title of the Premier League era, that first title that so many of us have seen. And they had to overcome the biggest rivals to do it, that team that was always there to knock us down.
That, Richard says, was a different kind of tension to the match in 2019.
Liverpool was a little bit different because it felt like City had something to lose. They were the reigning champions, but they went into that game knowing that if Liverpool won, realistically, they would have put themselves out of sight. It was horrifically tense, and I think at that point, really, the City-Liverpool game, and maybe any City-Liverpool game since, has been between arguably the two best teams in Europe. So it even comes with that tension of just going into the game knowing that you're playing an absolutely spectacular team. There may be trouble
ahead. Richard's hit upon something there. It's not just playing the best teams that make the most pressured games, it's playing the best teams with something on the line. It's the knowledge that the season could come down to that match, and that match alone. At this point, we know you're all thinking about QPR in 2012. Well, spoiler alert, we told our guests not to pick that game because we'll be doing something a lot more in-depth about it at the end of this season, even though we accept that, yes, it was a very, very tense afternoon. Other title-deciding games were in the mix, though. Kieran Murray remembers quite a nervy evening against Aston Villa in 2014.
This was a game that was postponed for ages because of City's involvement in the League Cup final and things like that. So it kept getting put off and put off, and the fact that it became the second last game of the season then just added the tension to it.
Kieran says that game was worse because of the heavy rain that night, but when the breakthrough came from Edin Dzeko, everyone was able to relax a bit.
So I missed the entirety of the first half because of traffic, and the rain and stuff didn't help. So I was listening on the radio and it was crazy tense. You could almost hear the tension from the stadium as you listened on the radio. I don't know, you know, just that traffic jam and everything just felt angsty and anxious and apprehensive, and it was just horrible. So when Dzeko opened the score, and it was just a complete release, such a bubble bursting.
He says the mood changed quickly that evening.
Full time was amazing, obviously because it was a night game and because of the rain and because it looked as if we'd wrapped up the 3 points. The stadium had kind of emptied out a little bit, but it was worth staying till full time. Mainly because Yaya scored one of the great City goals, one of the great Yaya Touré goals. And then it was just a party atmosphere after that. All we needed after that game was a point against West Ham at home. I think City had only been top that season for like 11 days or something. And then all of a sudden, here we were, penultimate game of the season. After 64 minutes of a 0-0 terrifying draw, suddenly winning 4-0.
That release at full time in the penultimate game of the season was echoed some 5 years later. This time City had had a battle with Leicester, and Vincent Kompany's long range pile driver in the second half was enough for the 3 points. Adam Carter says he was a bag of nerves.
We had to wait till the actual Monday night to play our game, so it was an even longer wait, which I think added to the tense atmosphere around the stadium. And obviously as the minutes went on, you're looking around thinking, where's the goal coming from? When Kompany stepped up in the 70th minute. And I think by that point, there's obviously the famous adage of, oh, Vinny, don't shoot. But actually I was willing him to shoot because we needed something that wasn't going to come from tippy-tappy football. This was something that needed a thunderbolt to break the net.
Adam says his mind was racing as the minutes ticked by.
You're thinking of all the other outcomes that could happen if we don't go through that game without a victory. And then Iheanacho steps up at the other end and I like to think passes it blissfully wide of Edison's post, just as a nod to his previous standing as a City player, and the Liverpool fans were up in arms about that, so that adds a nice little touch to it as well.
So far we've only covered tense games at the Etihad when the title was on the line, but this wouldn't be City if there weren't equally nervy moments at the other end of the table too. When we asked for the games when he felt the pressure, Dan Burke's mind went right back to the first season at Eastlands and a 1-0 win over Newcastle.
I remember we went into that game, we were just 3 points above the relegation zone at the time. Relegation was a real danger. We hadn't won since that the 4-1 win over United. I think that was 8 games previously, a couple of months earlier. It was the third to last game of the season, and it was billed as a real must win for City. If we didn't win this one, you know, there was a very serious chance we were going down. And it was against a Newcastle side who were decent at the time and pushing for top four, so it was going to be a really tough game.
Dan still remembers the winning goal clear as day.
In the second half, Nicolas Anelka found a rare bit of space down the right, and he crossed in for Paulo Wanchope to head in what proved to be the winner, and everyone went crazy. I think aside from the Derby game that season, I think that was probably the most we'd celebrated a goal at Eastlands at that point. It felt like such a huge relief, like a weight was being lifted from our shoulders. And I remember everyone celebrating coming out the ground at full time like we'd won the league or something. Not that most of us knew what that felt like at the time.
So at this stage, you might be thinking that the high-pressure games are confined to the title run-ins and the relegation fights. But, as Chris Higginbottom remembers, that's certainly not true.
In terms of confidence going into the game, I don't remember being too overly confident. I mean, I never am anyway. But back then, we certainly weren't a force that would merit 100% confidence going into a game like that.
He's talking about the match with Spurs in 2010. City lost 1-0 on a night that sent their opponents into the top four at their expense.
The longer the game went on at 0-0, you do get those old familiar jitters starting to form, and I don't know, there's something about Spurs as well. The longer the game goes on, you are starting to think, oh, aye, this has got a horrible 1-0 written all over it. And when Crouch scored, yeah, you are thinking,
that was the inevitable. It was building towards it anyway. He missed a chance by, I don't know, about 3 millimetres that a taller man would probably have scored. But he didn't get that one. Got a scruffy header later on.
Chris says his experience of City in the 90s, though, had got him ready for the disappointment of losing that tense game.
It was treading a well-familiar path through an all-too-familiar emotional wasteland, really. So, although it was disappointing at the time, I think even then, when you were at the beginning of a journey, there was also bigger disappointments in the past, especially looking back over the the rose-tinted retrospecticals. Disappointed, but not overly gutted.
That night obviously didn't end how City fans wanted, but as we've heard from some of the other podcast regulars, there have been plenty of tense matches at the Etihad that have gone City's way. Richard Burns says the feeling after them is almost indescribable.
The release of tension is maybe the greatest joy in victory as a football fan. It was just the most outrageous build up right up until the full-time whistle, and then just euphoric celebration. That's the word I'd use to describe it. Just pure euphoria.
And City fans will be hoping for plenty of that pure euphoria over the next few weeks.
Hi, I'm David James, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
That was a look at some of the tensest Etihad games. Chris, you're obviously in that feature, talking about the Spurs game in 2010. Are there any other games that stand out for you as the tensest ones you've been at?
That other Spurs game with the handball, Llorente goal and the disallowed.
The Sterling game, yeah.
I'm still not over that, to be honest. honestly, it really, really still rankles. Can I have a moment?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. Yeah. I'll go to John then. While you compose yourself, I'll go to John. Any tense moments for you, John?
Yeah, as ever, I'm going to go way back. I'm going to go back to 2000, when the last home league game of the season against Birmingham City, needing to win to confirm promotion. Although obviously it was subsequently, was it Charlton or Ipswich who ballsed it up? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was Charlton against Ipswich the next day. Charlton had already won the league, and Ipswich had to win at the Valley to do it. And
it was wasn't it? Yeah,
and they went there and won like 3-0 or something, just like really bossed it. And I was like, "Could you had one job, Charlton?"
Yeah. Well, it was but that Birmingham City game, if I remember rightly, was a Friday night.
It was, yeah.
And I was just felt ill and sick all day, completely, just absolute bag of nerves. And by full time, I just didn't feel any sort of joy or happiness. I just had a massive headache. I just wanted to go out.
Did you go on the pitch?
I didn't go on the pitch.
I did.
No. I was on the pitch a week later at Blackburn. But so you were on the pitch after Birmingham?
Yeah, I can't really remember it. My mate Will reminded me of it because he picked it as one of his games that made me, which I think is next week, actually. But he reminded me that we went on the pitch after that game. And I think he says he took a handful of the penalty spots. Something.
There's always some sort of strange-looking person doing a sort of hoedown jig. Was that you? This game?
That probably wasn't me, because I don't dance in public, as it happens. Right. So, yeah. Chris, are you composed? Are you back with us?
Yeah, back in the room.
Yeah. Any other tense games that you remember, or is it just Spurs every time?
You can't really have this conversation without mentioning the QPR game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I did say in the feature that we were discounting that, because we are doing something a bit later on, but I didn't say that to you, so crack on.
Yeah, well, I'm counting it. There it is, counted. I mean, that was unbelievable levels of just such a massive downer when you resigned to not doing it, and then obviously we all know what happened then. And yeah, pandemonium, joy. I could still watch that even now, and you get goosebumps and tears in your eyes. Just ridiculous.
Yeah, well, John gets the same with Bob Taylor's goal against Birmingham, don't you, John?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's even on YouTube, is it?
It must be somewhere. Yeah, it must be. Right, that's the end of this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests, Chris Higginbottom.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Jonathan Smith.
Thank you.
If you'd like some more podcasts to listen to, or you'd like to listen to this show each week without the adverts, then you can sign up to our Patreon page. There's a bonus episode every Monday. This week's is a City Heaven, City Hell. Newcastle fan Alex Hurst joined me and Dom Farrell to pick the good and the bad between the two sides. Here's a clip.
There was a real sense of that's done. And I remember the weeks, it was a Sunday, so there was a full week to the QPR game. And I remember that the week just kind of feeling fairly sort of blissful. I mean, whenever you remember the end of the season, you always remember it being sunny. And I was living in the centre of Manchester at the time, so it can't have been sunny all week. That is my memory of it, of just it being sort of like this, you know, this blissful sort of hazy time. It kind of, particularly the way Torre scored, that opening goal just looks so, they say it's talking of a heaven game. It's such a heavenly finish, the way it sort of, Alison, help me out. Who would Newcastle's goalie have been at the time?
Tim Krul. Yeah.
It pitches sort of just in front of Krul and spins into the net. It's a little bit like in cricket where a bowler gets one to nip back and sort of rip out the off stump. It was just a beautiful looking goal. And it was like, right, that's it. That's going to be the image of the title win, or so we thought.
More of that on this week's Patreon bonus show. You can get that right now by signing up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. There's 2/3 of a season of shows in our new formats, plus all of last season's played for both episodes available as well. All well worth the £2 per month, even if we do say so ourselves. Join me again next week to review everything that happens in these two big games coming up. And remember, deep breaths, everyone. It begins.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.